going on, party people? It's me, Rich. I'm back again with another episode of BTC 2.0. I know it's been a couple of weeks, so hold your horses. We're back this week with Eisner-nominated writer Philip Kennedy Johnson. We have a fun conversation. Check it out. Hey, guys. Welcome to the show. Philip Kennedy Johnson. Philip, how are you?
I'm great, man. How are you?
I'm pretty good, man. I'm pretty good. You're a busy guy. I want to talk to you about all the comics you're writing, but first I want to share a quick little story for everybody watching. You did something that nobody has ever done at a Comic-Con. And I've been going to conventions since I was a kid, right? You write the new Alien book for Marvel. I went up to you. I said, hey, you know, I'd love a signed copy. You turn around and you said, hey, by the way, this is a variant cover. It costs $20. Is that okay with you? And I was like, yeah, absolutely. You personalize it to me, put it in my pocket, had a quick conversation, and then I went along my merry way. Nobody's ever done that. And I got to say, I really appreciate you doing that, because that's very kind and very classy.
Oh, well, thanks, man. Yeah, I just don't want to give somebody a book and they think it's cover price, because normally I prefer to sell everything cover price when I've got it. And that's all I had left was the $20 one. And I just didn't want to stick somebody with the book they didn't want, you know?
Yeah, got it right here.
Hey, that's awesome.
But yeah, like super cool, man. Like that was like a real, real class act. Usually it's like the handlers just like slapping the money out of your hand and throwing it in a bin or something. You know what I mean?
Right. Right. Boom. In your face. $20.
Yeah, exactly. You know, but no, like I really appreciate it. That was really cool. How was the rest of the con for you?
It was great, man. Yeah, it's I have not done a lot of conventions this last year, obviously, but I did Awesome Con, Baltimore, and New York, and they were all very positive. They were all very, I mean, honestly, they weren't as crowded as they used to be for obvious reasons. I mean, I wish the reasons were more, you know, positive, but the experience of the convention itself was actually really great. At New York Comic Con, the artist alley is usually just this slow moving wave of people that you're just trapped in. And you're just so trapped down there, and it's still awesome because there's great people there. And I mean, it's great for a lot of reasons, but this year there was more room to move around and it wasn't quite so packed in, and it was great. And I had a lot of awesome conversations with fans like yourself, and Baltimore was super cool too. It's been a really good con season for me this past couple of months.
That's awesome. Do you actually like the process of packing all your stuff, getting out there and meeting everybody?
Yeah. I mean, packing it all up and everything. I haven't actually done a whole lot of conventions even before everything got rolling. Like I kind of reached a new level of prominence in the industry, right when COVID was starting to hit us. Right. So I, when I was tabling before, I would table with Boom Studios. I would go and kind of help them with their stuff, because I had several books out with Boom. Mm-hmm. I would sell my work and also kind of help other people with their stuff at the Boom booth. And now that I have enough stuff other places, it makes sense to go on my own. I'm still kind of new at it. And I have more work to take than I used to. So it's a little bit of a chore to drag everything around, but it's well worth it. I mean, it's, you know, talking to the fans is always great. And, you know, seeing friends in the industry I haven't talked to in a long time, it's a great experience.
That's awesome, man. How long have you been doing comics?
My first printed book came out in November 2015. That was Last Sons of America at Boom. And then right after that, we did Warlords of Appalachia, and that came out just about a year later. And around that same time, I was working on my first licensed work with them. I did an Adventure Time short that actually got an Eisner nom, which was cool.
Okay.
Then I did a Kong book and Power of the Dark Crystal, the Dark Crystal sequel. My work at Boom grew quickly, but it was mostly just there. And then one of those books got noticed by DC, another one got noticed by Marvel, and then everything kind of went in other directions after that.
That's awesome. It's cool how like stuff kind of snowballs like that, like almost out of nowhere, where it's like, you know, like I talked to so many people in the industry and it's like nobody has a direct answer of like why, you know. It's like I do X, Y, and Z, and then all of a sudden Marvel and DC are like, hey, can you do stuff for us now?
Yeah, it's tricky because they don't, if you want to do a DC or Marvel book, you don't solicit them really. They want to come to you. And that's just kind of how it works. If you have to pitch companies to get started, But you're not pitching DC for your, for their Batman story right off the bat. Like you have to get there. And so first you're pitching the independent publishers. With, for me, that was Boom. I pitched Boom for a thing I wanted to do there, and that worked out. And but of course, by the time one made it across the plate, I'd already pitched, you know, a ton of other shit there and elsewhere.
Yeah.
So it's hard. It's really hard to bust in. And once you do bust in, if you prove that you're good to work with, that you're, you know, not a jerk, that you can turn in your stuff on time, that you're a good collaborator and all that, and the book, you know, itself is solid, then other places will start knocking.
Yeah. That's fascinating. I think in the industry now, like from a fan's perspective, it's cool seeing who's on what book, because everybody, and yourself included, it's like this workhorse attitude. Like you have a ton of books coming out every month, like guys like Donny Cates and Tinian, Jeff Lemire, just putting like solid stuff out for a variety of companies. Did you grow up a fan of comics?
Oh my God. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I learned how to read off of comics straight up. My dad brought home, I didn't have the kind of home where you played a lot. I didn't have a lot of playmates, but I had a lot of books, and dad would bring home all these little ripped up comics from various places and like from flea markets or garage sales. And, I just loved them. They're all kind of beat up, and I ran and read them until they fell apart, some of them.
Yeah.
But I had all these old Spider-Man team up books. I had a lot of World's Finest and Brave and the Bold. You know, Batman, Superman team ups as well, and you know, individual stuff with each of them. Mm-hmm. A little bit of Legion, a little bit of Justice League. But yeah, it was a lot. I mean, probably more DC than the other stuff. And I just really fell in love with those characters, especially Batman and Superman. I think early on, those are characters that connected with me. I connected with them just so strongly.
Oh, for sure. And that was that like mid 80s Batman, Superman.
Honestly, a lot of the books I was reading back then were old, even by the time I got them.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So there's a lot of Silver Age stuff.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And there was some stuff, like some Bronze Age too. Let's see. But then at some point I was able to start, I did start buying things off the spinner racks at the grocery stores and stuff back when you could get them at, you know, just pretty much anywhere, gas stations or a grocery store. So then I was getting stuff like, let's see, around that time Batman would have been like Norm Breyfogle maybe.
Okay.
Or before that, Jim Aparo too. I have some Jim Aparo Batman back when he was the regular guy.
Yeah.
Like when the Outsiders were still a relatively new thing.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That stuff, that was like my bread and butter when I was a kid. Cause I kind of inherited my brother's 12 years my senior. So when I was growing up, I inherited like a lot of his stuff. And then that's about the time when I was starting to get like the 75 cent Batman issues done by Norm Breyfogle, do like all that stuff is like very familiar, you know, like the Man of Steel stuff, the John Byrne, DC stuff, which was like, a lot of it is like, the thing I love about comics is like, you kind of go in waves of like, just these golden waves of creativity, you know, and that there's like a nice pocket in that era that's like, that's holds up in a very interesting way.
Yeah, totally. No, I have a lot of affection for those books. And later on, I still have all those old comics. They're boxed up in this room and other rooms. But I also buy up the hardcover collections of those when I see them. Like I saw the Batman and the Outsiders collections come out, and I didn't even hesitate, dude. I was so into that.
Because
I had some of those, but I didn't have complete runs or anything. It was just whatever was in those old, you know, piles of stuff that dad was finding for, you know, quarter piece or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. That book is pretty fantastic. I was trying to explain it to my wife about how weird all the characters were. And then it was like, you know, it's like that. I think for me, it was like that first time you see Batman in that different light where he's not with the Justice League, but he's got his own kind of band of like misfits. And I remember being like really, really into Metamorpho.
Yeah, totally. Metamorpho was rad. The characters were super interesting. And most of them had powers. So you got like these crazy powers like Geoforce and Metamorpho. Yeah. Katana was super cool. There was that weird shit with Alfred where he became the... What was the name of that character? Did he just become the Outsider? Is that the name of his character?
I think so. Yeah, they threw him into like a bunch of stuff like towards, I want to say, like the middle of the run, right?
Yeah, there was something happened, and he became this other like villain. And then so they had to like save Alfred from himself. It was crazy, super out.
Yeah,
but yeah, just that I like the idea of Batman as kind of the leader of his own little, you know, FU Justice League.
Right. Yeah. You know, it's super endearing. Do you still collect now, or is it like, are you so busy that you're just like, you know what, let me just write these books and then do whatever
honestly, else I have it to was do. It was never so much about collecting for me. It was always just about reading them. I just wanted the stories. I was never incredibly precious about, of course. I mean, I'd never been in a comic shop. I mean, I had seriously never been in a comic store to speak of until after my master's degree or something. Well, no, I guess in my undergrad, I found one comic shop and I stepped inside. It's like, oh, wow, there's nothing but comics in here. This is awesome. Because before that, it was, I'd only ever bought stuff either, you know, at places where people were selling their trash or, you know, grocery stores and stuff. I'd never been in a store where they just sold comic books. It was just this amazing thing. I was out in the sticks and that wasn't really a thing where I was. So the whole collector's culture of boarding and bagging books and having them graded and everything, that was just not, you know, on my radar until way later. I was just getting them just to read them. They're all made out of newsprint. And that, I mean, I don't think I ever had a comic that wasn't at least a little bit beat up.
Yeah.
If not just completely wrecked. Well, some of them were those, I forget the name of the condition, but some, I guess the top copy of a box of comics, they would just take a box cutter and just like rip off, like cut off half the cover or something.
Like
mark the others. I had a bunch of those. I had comics that were just missing half the cover.
As long as you got the whole story. Where did you grow up, by the way?
Iowa.
Okay. So you were like, we drove through Iowa not too long ago. And it was like, for me, cause I grew up in New York, I'm like, this is amazing. Nothing.
Yeah. I hadn't been there much since I left. I was there as a kid and then Kentucky after that. And then went to school in Texas for a while. All the red state hits.
Okay. So you're a writer, you're a musician, and you're a soldier, right? Am I wrong in making that statement? So
no.
how do you combine the three? When there's so many questions, and I know you're probably very busy, but if we can just get through a couple of them, like when did you decide to join the army? Did the music have something to do with it? And like, give me like the trifecta of writer, musician, soldier.
Well, my whole life I've been very curious. Well, I've always was loved making things. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of been my driving passion always. Mm-hmm. I just want to make things. And I don't mean things that like I'd build houses if I could, but it was always mostly things like, you know, telling stories and playing piano and playing trumpet and, you know, composing music and drawing. I was probably, if I had to pick one passion, I guess when I was a little kid, it would have been art. I'd really love to draw. But I was also kind of out in the middle of nowhere all the time. So I didn't like things like classes for stuff like that, or even just like educate myself in any meaningful way. It wasn't really happening. I was just a guy that just loved doing this stuff. Or in high school, I was very curious about the military and I was kind of checking it out, but I was pretty ignorant about it. And I didn't know if I just assumed that once I became a soldier, I would just be like a capital S soldier, like a war fighter. And that's what soldiers were.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not understanding that there's actually many different kinds of careers you can follow in the military.
Yeah.
I didn't know any of that. I thought I was like, okay, I'm going to become a soldier and just, you know, go to war. And that's the gig. And then later when I discovered, I ended up going to college for music. I became a trumpet player. In high school, it became clear that I was like, okay, I'm actually pretty good at this. And this is kind of my best ticket out of here. So I'm going to put art aside for a while. I was still drawing. It's kind of for fun. I was pretty good for a kid. I was good. But I wasn't like, you know, anything that would turn heads professionally, but I was good. And I was very unschooled. And I mean, in music too, I hadn't really taken lessons or anything, but I just practiced my ass off. So I was like, yeah, I'll just do this. And I managed to get a scholarship for music in college.
That's awesome.
Kind of left art behind. And I became aware of the military bands and that they have those bands all over the place. Any place there's a decent sized military component. There's a band there too.
Yeah.
To play for ceremonies and things, but also for morale and whatever else.
Mm-hmm.
There's a centuries old, relationship between, you know, music and soldiering.
Yeah.
But I was really taken with the Washington DC bands and mm-hmm. the Academy bands as well. I was like, damn, that seems like a really cool job. The musicians are incredible. The benefits are great. You got a job where you're playing music, but not just because it's fun, because like for higher purpose, you're playing for things that matter and mm-hmm. with other really great musicians, it gives you kind of a home base in a city where you can play other work as well. It just made a lot of sense to me, but I also wanted to do it all as a musician. I didn't want to just do that. So instead of auditioning right away, I just wanted to do other kinds of things musically. So I played in a blues band that was really good. I played in some jazz stuff. I played in the Glenn Miller band for about a year and a half.
That's cool.
Toured with them, toured the world. And then eventually it's like, yeah, let's do this. So I started auditioning for those bands and got into the Army Field Band in Washington, D.C., which is where I am now. So that whole time I'm not really reading for fun anymore. I kind of set comics aside. I still liked them in theory, but I hadn't gone into a comic store in forever. And I mean, I'd hardly been in them before that, but I just loved the books that I had and, loved just nerd stuff. But then my younger brother, who's also a musician, a trumpet player and an artist, decided he wanted to go the other way. He wanted to become an artist. And didn't really know how to get started. He was just just a kid living in the country, didn't know what to do to break into the industry. And I didn't know either. So I was like, dude, just come move in with me and we'll figure it out. We'll start going to conventions. We'll find some good shops. We'll read, you know, how to books. We'll do whatever. We'll get to know comics for dummies. We'll figure it out together. And we totally did that. We just started going to conventions and doing everything we talked about. He discovered that there's a job in the Army called multimedia illustrator where you can enlist and just be an artist for the Army. Like, they'll train you up and they'll train you up in Illustrator and Photoshop and InDesign and teach you how to make all kinds of materials for the Army, whether it be educational stuff or, you know, advertising or, you know, more like art pieces or, you know, logos, whatever, whatever they need. He was doing all that for about 6 years. And while he was doing that, I was still going to conventions and that I'd already kind of gotten my foot back in the door. Thanks to him. I'd kind of gotten my feet back into comics again and, found that I really loved it and not just reading them. I was so taken with how far, the art form had come since I'd gotten out of it. But I also just really love the collaborative nature of making them. I love how they're put together. And it seemed very familiar to me as a guy who played a lot of jazz, a lot of small group jazz, just a group of small professionals who all shape the product between them just made a lot of sense to me. So I kept going to conventions and met a lot of artists and eventually put together some pitch packets. And one of those became Last Sons of America. So now I'm in this weird place where I still have my music career. I'm still playing with the Army.
Yeah.
But I'm also making comics and writing for DC and Marvel. So right now the plan is to get to 20 years and then see where we're at. I've been in the Army 16 years now.
Wow.
So I'm going to put in my 20 and then see where things are, but potentially do my 20 and get out and just write after that. But we'll see.
That's awesome. So around what year was it? You had mentioned you hadn't read for a while and then you picked up some stuff and you were blown away by like what a leap comics took. Like around what year did that happen?
Oh man. I can tell you what was on the shelves when I went back. So when I left, okay. So in high school I was reading, I was picking up more and more new stuff by then off the spinner rack. Like after Superman had died and come back is when I started picking up stuff off the shelves. So I bought The Death of Superman, like the paperback, I think.
Yeah.
And then I was buying The Return of Superman anytime a new one came out. So I was reading comics through like the beginning of the long hair Superman era.
Yeah.
After he was back. and I was reading Nightfall, Night's End, and all that, and Batman.
Yeah.
And I subscribed to Batman for a while after Bruce Wayne came back. I was reading Age of Apocalypse, like all the Joe Mad X-Men stuff.
Yeah.
And then I got out. And when I got back in, let's see. I remember seeing The Boys on the shelf.
Oh, right on.
And all these superhero deconstructions, like The Boys.
Yeah.
Watchmen, which I never, of course, that's been around forever, but I never read it.
Mm-hmm.
Irredeemable was coming out new. Okay. I think the first trade of Irredeemable might have been out then when I was looking around. Lock and Key was coming out, I think. Okay. American Vampire was like brand new.
Mm-hmm.
Joss Whedon, John Cassidy's Astonishing X-Men.
Oh, for sure.
So yeah, the contrast from the stuff that I remember to the stuff that was coming out new, I was like, damn, dude, this is so different. And I was so impressed by the art I was seeing. So yeah, it was quite a change. And I was just so taken with it.
So, so you're a full-time army musician.
Mm-hmm.
So that's like every day you're somewhere.
Yeah.
Honing your craft basically with your trumpet.
Yeah, I mean, I practice at home, and we have rehearsals as well. I had rehearsals today, which I apologize. We got a little late start today.
Don't worry about it. I appreciate it, but don't worry about it. I'm the easiest person on the planet. So now, I read on your website that you have a fondness for jazz, right?
I do. Yeah.
Does any of that musicality play a part in how you write and how you want your characters and stories to come across? Because I love the juxtaposition of writing with music depending on mood. Is that an influence for you?
Yeah, definitely. The influence of music is twofold. For one, I'm a huge fan of Tolkien's work.
Okay.
And Tolkien had this habit of putting, at least in his Middle Earth stuff, he would put a lot of songs and poems in the prose, and I just thought that was so cool. I was so impressed with it, not just in the craft it would take to do that, but also I love the conciseness of the world building that you can put into those songs. Like there's so much you can communicate in the body of a song. Like if you want to actually, instead of just explaining like through exposition what the world is like, the history of things, how the different races interact or whatever, you can write a song and communicate a lot of that stuff in a very elegant way. So I always love that. And whenever I have opportunities to do that in ways that don't feel shoehorned in, I do that in my own work now. So that's one way in which music is my love of music comes through. As far as my love of jazz, specifically small group jazz. So people sometimes hear big band and call that jazz. It's kind of a jazz style, but it's not what I like. When I think of jazz, I think of like a small group, like a jazz quintet or something. When you've got, typically piano, bass, drums, and then a horn or two or guitar or something, some other kind of a solo instrument. And that's the stuff that I really love performing. Probably if I had to choose one style to do, which would be an impossible decision, but if I had to pick one, I really love small group jazz. If everyone's really doing their job, if you replace any one person in a jazz combo, the product completely changes.
Right.
And that's what I found in comics as well. Even if you just change the colors, or you just change the inker, or you just change the letter, or even like everyone plays a very important role, especially if you write with those people in mind. If you're writing something for them to their strengths, or making sure you're giving everyone something to do and not just some throwaway role.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone can really make a mark on that book. So when I'm writing, I try to keep everyone else in mind. I try to basically not just do your own job as well as you can, but also like part of doing your job well is setting up everyone else for success as well. So if you're writing for someone who wants a lot of direction, wants a lot of photo reference or art reference or whatever, yeah, you should accommodate that in the script. If you got somebody else who prefers as little direction as possible, you should keep that in mind. If you're writing for someone who is not a native English speaker, or if you're writing for someone who, they really like, they do their best work when they're drawing animals or you know, cars and structures, or, you know, really dynamic movement, like a lot of speed lines and kind of a James Herron, very dynamic kind of style. Mm-hmm. You should have that in mind. Just, you know, write with your artist in mind, you know, and same thing for the inkers, colorists, letters, everyone else, like know what they're good at and what they want to see. So that, like knowing the craft of jazz, like I do, I try to approach writing that way as well. Cause it's, you know, at least in a collaborative medium.
Did you, this is like a two part for you. I'm going to go back a little bit, and you mentioned Tolkien's work, right? Clearly you're a Lord of the Rings Hobbit fan.
I am.
What was your reaction hearing the Misty Mountain song for the first time?
Oh my God. Well, okay. I know that's not the way that Tolkien envisioned that song, but I actually prefer the Howard Shore. It's really beautiful. I loved it.
Right. Like I remember seeing that for the, because when you read it, when you, it's, yes, it's not what is in The Hobbit, but when you read it, and then you, when I heard that for the first time, I remember as soon as it came out on like a Blu-ray or whatever, I just kept rewinding it. You know?
Yeah. Dude, me too. When I heard the score, I was like, bye. And I just listened to it a lot. In fact, I actually arranged it. I arranged that song for my brass quintet to play.
Oh, get out of here. That's cool.
Yeah. I play in a brass quintet as part of my job with the Army Field Band. The quintet's called the Federal Brass. And they're super capable. We try to kind of push each other and write a lot of stuff that's not typically heard in brass quintet. And often that's like jazz stuff, but sometimes it's like film score music or game music. I actually did an arrangement of, I did like a theme and variation version of Tetris for us to play. That's meant to express like a kid playing Tetris and like feeling and hearing the panic level rising as the blocks get higher and higher.
Oh, that's cool.
It's really fun. I mean, I got away with it because it's public domain. It's based on that old Russian folk tune.
Right.
You know, so you can, there's no copyright issue. But I also arranged Misty Mountains for quintet, and it turned out really cool. It was fun.
Did you have a singer for it, or did you all kind of like do like the humming?
Just brass. And actually it became kind of I want to say the back half actually kind of became the Shire tune.
Oh, cool.
It was more like a, not exactly a medley, but yeah, anyway, there were no lyrics in that one, but no, it turned out nice. Cause there's usually a brass quintet will have a tuba on the bass voice and then trombone. It usually goes tuba, trombone, horn, and then two trumpets. But this particular group, we use bass trombone for the tuba voice. So we have two trombones, and it's more of a directional kind of in your face kind of sound. And it really suited the low voice sound.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah. Also that Shire tune, that's my alarm every morning.
Oh my God. That sounds really kind of pleasing and charming. I might have to do that.
It really is, honestly, like, cause you know, like it's not only for me, it's not just my alarm. It's also what my wife is going to hear. So instead of like very abrasive, like thrash metal, it's the happy medium. And you wake up with like a nice little bit of all right, you know,
no shit. I'm going to change it to that like today.
that's awesome. A great idea. Awesome.
I have my usual alarm that I use for everything else. Is this recording that I made of my son when he was super little. He's probably like right around 1 year old. Mm-hmm. We took a couple of, he was walking around the house looking for me. He went, daddy. And then later he's like, daddy. And I took those two and I made it into like in a ringtone.
Oh, that's awesome. And
it's fucking adorable, but it's also like it's like it is a kind of a slap in the face when you first hear it because it's kind of loud.
You wake up like alarmed.
Yeah, no, I love it. It makes me feel good, but maybe for an alarm, the Shire would be better.
That's awesome. Okay, so we're gonna go. I go a little back and forth with these. So like, let's go back to you mentioning you're working with artists. You kind of almost got to cater to their style. Who are some of your favorite collaborators? Because like you've worked with a ton of great artists so far, you know?
I have. Man, okay. I'm going to give you some names, but I do feel a little bad about it because I don't want to, I've been unbelievably blessed with super capable and talented people. I mean, I could give you 30 names and they'd all be just as true. I am just off the top of my head, people I really love working with. I've got to say Ricardo Federici. That guy is a maniac. He's so good. He's like a Dutch master that just went forward in time and just started making comic books. It's just unbelievably good what he can do.
Yeah.
He did The Last God with me. And now he's about to be, starting in January, he's going to be my ongoing Action Comics artist as well.
Oh, right on.
And we're doing all the stuff on War World, and God, it could not fit him any better than it does. I mean, he's just made for that Conan, Robert E. Howard type stuff.
Oh, for sure.
And that January issue is when the Sword and Sandal stuff really gets rolling.
That's really cool.
He's going to just fucking crush it. So anyway. So that's Ricardo.
Yeah.
Mikael Hanin did my Superman Worlds of War issues. And honestly, he's right there with Ricardo as far as his talent and his, and how thoughtful a collaborator he is too. I mean, when he does it,
cool.
Usually I see, I get thumbnails first, like real rough drawings, mm-hmm. so that we can talk about POV and the layouts of the pages and everything. He does not do that, but he and I seem to see the page in such similar ways that I don't even need to see him. Like whenever it comes back, it almost always looks just like I imagined. Even when it's different, it's always better than I envisioned. Okay. He actually puts the text in too. Like he makes sure he's leaving space for the text on the page by actually dropping the text in himself, just like placeholder text, to make sure that there's room mm-hmm. for it. Some artists, as great as they are, don't do that. And so then that's a concern. Like you have to always pare down your text to when the artist's there, because you don't want to cover anything. But Mikael leaves space for that, which is super thoughtful. And he's just a maniac artist. He used to be an architect, like a successful architect.
Oh, wow.
And he just started doing comic books, and he's so good.
That's awesome.
One of the first artists I worked with is a guy named Steve Beach. Steve uh-huh. is just a horror just a genius. And I don't throw around that word lightly. I mean, he has this encyclopedic knowledge of horror movies. I mean, I know horror movies, mm-hmm. but every time I want a lesson on horror film, Steve's a guy I talk to. He gives me names I never heard of. Some of them are like upsetting stuff I never would have found on my own.
Oh, wow.
like dark web type shit. Like you kind of, you don't know what's out there unless you've really combed through Shudder and found all the old stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's just a complete genius, and I love working with him. There's a website, actually, there's a web comic on my site called The Lost Boys of the U-Boat Bremen that Steve illustrated. Mm-hmm. And it is just unbelievable. And that was his first comic ever. Since then, he's gotten much better even. He did a spinoff issue of Last God, and he is doing some covers. Like he just did a cover for Arkham City with Dan Waters. Mm-hmm. And what else? He did some of the back matter in my source book for Last God. And he and I are doing another thing together now. So yeah, I love Steve.
Awesome.
I mean, I could give you 10 more names, but I'm probably gonna, I'll throw Phil Hester in there too. Phil Hester is a super, just a class act and an artist. And just a joy to work with.
Yeah. He's a cool dude. He came on, I want to say like 5 or 6 episodes ago.
Oh, nice.
And I
love Phil. We discovered he's actually from Iowa too. He lives there still. Mm-hmm. And we discovered that we were distantly related, which is kind of funny.
Oh, wow. That's a coincidence, huh?
Yeah, I know.
We'll do a couple more questions, then I'll get you out of here if that's cool with you. Sure. Talk to me about Alien. You clearly are a fan of the franchise. From my fan perspective, as soon as I cracked open that first issue, I was like, oh, this dude gets it, you know?
Oh, thanks, man. Yeah, I love those movies. I mean, I love the comics too, but I do feel like at some point the comics and the films kind of felt like they're on different paths.
Yeah.
They just felt like different universes, you know? And I really love the film version. And I wanted the Marvel run to feel like it belongs in that mm-hmm. universe. So yeah, I mean, when I found out that I was even in the running for this, I was just all in their face. I was like, you got to give me this book. And I gave them everything that I wanted to do with it. And there's these things there's still these stories coming that I want to do with Alien.
Yeah.
That I cannot wait to get to. I mean, the second arc, I'm very proud of how the second arc is shaping up. There's characters in it I care a lot about, and I can't wait to see what's coming, but this third arc is going to be a huge deal. So I'm really excited for this next arc too. And actually we're about to put together an annual as well.
Oh, wow.
It's going to be really, really fun. And I felt like it should start tying back to the films a little more directly. So I'm going to try to do that in the annual.
It's such a great book. I recommend it to everybody. My brother's a huge Alien fan. Like most people I know are huge, like Ridley Scott alien fans, you know. Everything else was great, but that first movie, there's something so magical about that movie.
I'm glad to hear you say that. Everyone that I know seems to prefer the second one. And it is undeniably a 10 out of 10. Oh, yeah. I love that movie. It's probably the stronger movie if you had to pick one as far as emotional arcs and character, like, you know, motivation and all that stuff. Like those things that, you know, making the story about the character, not just about the plot.
Yeah.
I mean, if you go by the numbers, that second movie is above reproach. Mm-hmm. But that first one just blows you away over and over and over again. It's like being in a car crash emotionally over and over.
Oh my God.
And I just getting your mind blown constantly in that film. I try to put myself in the mindset of seeing it for the first time every time, which is impossible to imagine at this point. I mean, I could recite the whole thing, but
yeah.
But imagine seeing any of those scenes for the first time.
Yeah. You know,
just nuts.
And being like, I think there's like that. I throw that movie on at like very weird times like that. Like there's three movies that I throw on a lot. Clockwork Orange, Shining, and Alien.
Yeah, dude. Those are great choices.
Yeah, thank you. But like that Alien is like, I kind of do the same thing where it's like, all right, I want to sit down and I'm going to really take this in. But I know I'm going to miss something that I probably have never seen before. What do you got in your hand there?
This is the original motion picture soundtrack.
Like, oh, basically it's a gorgeous cover.
This LP of the score.
Yeah.
And I'll actually put this on and have it on while I'm writing sometime, just to keep myself in the film mindset when I'm writing and not letting myself get off track. I'll actually listen to the LP score.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I really love that. There's the comics shop that I found that I frequent, Third Eye Comics. There's Third Eye Comics and there's Third Eye Hobbies and Games or Games and something. Both stores are like 10,000 square feet apiece and they're like practically a writing store.
Oh, wow.
And, I don't go into the game shop that much, but when I do, they have this big LP collection in there that you can buy. And when I saw they had Alien in there, I was like, I don't even give a shit what this costs. Gotta have it. I love that score.
That's fantastic, man. So just a real quick question about it. This was your run is the first introduction to like the Alpha Alien, right?
Yeah. So I made up. Yeah.
So I was so blown away by that reveal. I think, was it like issue 5? Where was like the last page?
The very end of 4.
Yeah. Yeah. I was so blown away by it. Just like, holy shit, look at this monster. This is amazing.
Cool, right? Yeah. So that was tricky because here's the thing. So that first movie is like perfect.
Yeah.
And
yeah, yeah.
It ramps up to the next film. Very like the first three movies ramp up the physicality of the alien really well. The first one you see the xenomorph, and that's just that the big, you see just that one. And then of course the ultramorphs, and you get the idea of their life cycle. And the second one you're in the nest and there's a ton of them and you see the queen.
Yeah.
Then the third one, you see the quadruped, which is also a really, really cool development because then you realize that it changes depending on what the host is, which
is
something I always played with as a kid. When I was just, you know, doodling alien stuff, I was thinking about different animals might come out of. So when they confirmed that in the third movie and you see the four-legged one, I was just so, so excited about that. So now we're in this place where do we just keep taking it further and further? I mean, that's what the comics did before. That's what Dark Horse stuff did. Like you'd see, you know, the rhino or the alligator or the, you know, I don't know. I'm hesitant to just keep going bigger and bigger with it. And more out of the box. But you have to do something. You can't just show the same thing over and over because now we've seen it, right?
You can't
replicate that dinner scene from the first movie and have a chestburster moment and have that be enough because now we've all seen it. We all know what's coming. Mm-hmm. You've got to, you know, turn it up just a little bit without jumping the shark.
For sure.
As much as I would love to show like, you know, eagle aliens and, you know, all these crazy things, you don't want to make it seem silly. So the way I handled it in that first arc was, the first arc is the story of how Weyland Yutani finally gets their hands on an alien.
Right.
That's by the end of issue 6, we see how they got it. And so I started thinking about the Alpha, like the first Alpha meeting, the first one that they find. It's like, what if it comes from, it comes from a human, but the generation before that came from like these big goats, like these beasts of burden that we would breed for off-world colonies.
Okay.
And then that gave us the design for the Alpha, which is a much more satanic look. I'm like this Black Phillip kind of thing where the big horns and the hooves and everything. Mm-hmm. So it's like it's bigger and it has these satanic elements that make it that much scarier. So that it still made sense in the context of the standard warrior xenomorph, but not so different that it's like stupid, you know?
Yeah, no, for sure. I think, you know, like for me, just going with that first alien is like this, I always interpret it as this creature is fear incarnate, whatever this is.
Exactly.
You know, it is fear incarnate. You don't want to mess with it. And I just, it's a winning combination of like, of course somebody's going to mess with it. And then you get a ridiculous story, you know?
Right. Yeah, no, I've said that exact thing. I think the xenomorph is the best expression of horror ever seen on film.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's like the unknowing, everything, you know, cause it's not earth-based. It's so good. It's so good. All right. I got two more questions for you and then I'm going to let you go. All right.
All right.
Philip, what is the sandwich of your dreams?
Sandwich. I don't think about sandwiches all that much, but I do enjoy it. Let's see. I don't know. I do enjoy a good Cuban. Is that going to be my answer? I get, sometimes when you get like a fried chicken sandwich, those are pretty magical. And then plus lately I'm kind of I've been on this cutting phase. So I'm not eating sandwiches that much. And so I'm kind of, my fantasy is turning towards fried chicken sandwich. So yeah.
Oh yeah. Good fried chicken sandwich is fantastic. All right, man. Where can everybody find you?
Let's see. I have a website, philipkennedyjohnson.com, two L's in Philip. And I'm on Twitter at Philip K. Johnson. I'm at Facebook under my full name and Instagram with my full name with underscores between.
Cool, man. Listen, thank you for coming on. I really appreciate
it. Yeah, man. My pleasure. Thanks for having me on. It's good to meet you.
Yeah, same here, man.
Well, see you again. Excuse me, because we met at the con, apparently. So
yeah, no, listen, I appreciate it. Thank you again, man. All right. It was great talking to Philip. That was a great interview. It was a lot of fun. Anytime I get to nerd out about Alien and Lord of the Rings, I'm a happy camper. And it's also timely because he had two books out this week. Alien number 8, which is continuing the storyline from pretty much after Aliens. And the stuff that is being written in this book is so much fun. It harkens back to those first two flicks, like Big Time, where you have this monster who is pretty much like fear incarnate. Not so much evil, but it is fear roaming around and hunting people. You know, it is unwavering. This series has been fantastic. I feel like somebody could take this, throw it on the big screen. Maybe Ridley Scott could do something with it. It has that visual appeal, that fear factor. Not Fear Factory is one of my favorite bands. That Fear Factor, not the show with Joe Rogan either. And it takes you to like this different place. It kind of puts you in that mindset of being hunted by this animal. And also, we had Action Comics 1036 that was out this week, also by Philip Kennedy Johnson, which was a lot of fun. It continues the Superman Warworld massive story that will bring Superman into this sort of sword and sandal world where he is a little bit depowered and you're going to see him take on Mongul in his current state. Now, Mongul, I've always loved as a Superman villain. I think this is such a fresh take on it and a fresh take on the character. This also leaves Jonathan Kent behind to be the Superman of Earth. Superman is on Warworld right now, teaming up with the Authority, which is like another cool kind of story device, because he's got a lot of the Authority figures. You've got Manchester Black on the team. You have Enchantress on the team also. And it's basically about Superman trying to free Warworld slaves from Mongol. Pretty fantastic stuff. Really excited to see where it goes. And like I said, like, I'm a sucker for Gladiator stuff, and putting Superman in there, a lot of fun. Also, HeroQuest came out this week, which I'm a huge nerd for. It was an old game from back in the day that Hasbro actually funded. And it's been, I think I did the pre-order last year. It has been over a year. This giant thing shipped. I'm excited to play it this weekend. If you guys have picked one up, please let me know what your experience is. On that as well. Also, check out Regarding the Matter of Oswald's Body number 1. That's my book of the week this week. Christopher Cantwell does a great job of writing a very, very eye-grabbing, mind-grabbing, soul-stealing, shouldn't say soul-stealing, soul-grabbing issue number 1 of whatever comic he's writing. Regarding the Matter of Oswald's Body kind of gives you like, it's set in the early 60s. I'm not going to give too much away, but maybe you could figure it out from the title. But it's set in the early 60s. It's kind of like, so far, it's like a little bit of a heist, a little bit of an Ocean's 11. There's a team that's getting put together to do a secret mission, and each member of the team is from a different aspect of society. So a lot of fun. I suggest you check that out. Get in on the ground floor on that, because it's a number one that came out this week. Also, listen, if you want to find me, you can find me at BTC Rich on Twitter. You can find me on Mad Men Podcast. At Mad Men Podcast on Twitter. Check us out over there. And you can find me and my buddy Alex doing a film podcast called Film Class Zeros. That's at Film Zeros on Twitter and Film Class Zeros on iTunes. So please subscribe, check that out. Subscribe to this show. BTC Rich X is the YouTube channel. I'm going to have to tweak that a little bit to make it more concise with the show. But you could also find this show in audio form on iTunes at Behind the Counter 2.0. We have all our interviews up there finally. Big shout out to Suncast from gfqnetwork.com for hooking that up. Also, big shout out to Mr. Gonzo for helping stuff along the way as well. And guys, I will be back next week with another awesome interview. Much love and viva la raza.